twisted into a triumphant smile. "You are mine, Kell, and I will break you. Starting with your heart."
"Astrid!" But it was too late. Rye's body twisted toward Lila, and a single word left his mouth, "Catch!" before he cast the pendant into the air and drove the knife into his chest. 5. It happened so fast, the pendant moving at the same time as the blade. Kell saw Lila lunge out of the charm's reach, and he twisted back in time to see Rye burying the knife between his ribs.
"No!"
screamed Kell, surging forward. The necklace skidded along the floor and fetched up against the guard's boot, and Rye crumpled forward, the blade driven into the hilt, as Kell scrambled to his side and pulled the knife free. Rye, and it was Rye now, let out a choked sound, and Kell pressed his blood-streaked fingers to his brother's chest. Rye's shirt front was already wet, and he shuddered under Kell's touch. Kell had just begun to speak, to command the magic to heal the prince, when a guard slammed into him from the side, and they both went down on the inlaid floor. Several feet away, Lila was grappling with the other guard, while Kell's attacker clutched the talisman in one hand and tried to wrap the other around Kell's throat. Kell kicked and fought and dragged himself free, and when the guard, and Astrid within, charged forward, he threw up his hand. The metal armor and the body inside went flying backward, not into the wall, but into the banister at the balcony, which crumbled under the force and sent the guard's body over and down. It landed with a crash on the courtyard stones below. The sound followed instantly by screams, and Kell ran to the patio to see a dozen of the ball's dancers circling the body. One of them, a woman in a lovely green gown, reached out curiously for the pendant, now discarded on the courtyard stones.
"Stop!"
called Kell, but it was too late. The moment the woman's fingers curled around it, he could see her change, the possession rippling through her in a single drawn-out shiver, before her head flicked up at him, mouth drawing into a cold, grim smile. She turned on her heel and plunged into the palace.
"Kell!"
called Lila, and he spun, taking in the room for the first time as it was in disarray. The remaining guard lay motionless on the floor, a dagger driven through the visor of his helmet. And Lila crouched over Rye, her mask lifted and her tangled hands pressing against the prince's chest. She was covered in blood, but it wasn't hers. Rye's shirt was soaked through.
"Rye!"
said Kell, the word a sob, a shuddering breath as he knelt over his brother. He drew his dagger and slashed his hand, cutting deep.
"Hold on, Rye!"
He pressed his wounded palm to the prince's chest. It was rising and falling in staccato breaths, and said,
"Hass! Hassarai!"
"Heal." Rye coughed up blood. The courtyard below had exploded into activity, voices pouring up through the broken balcony. Footsteps were sounding through the halls, fists banging on the chamber doors, which Kell now saw were scrawled with spellwork. Locking charms.
"We have to go," said Lila.
"Hass! Hassarai!"
said Kell again, putting pressure on the wound. There was so much blood. Too much.
"I'm sorry," murmured Rye.
"Shut up, Rye," said Kell.
"Kell!"
ordered Lila.
"I'm not leaving him," he said simply.
"So take him with us."
Kell hesitated.
"You said the magic needs time to work. We can't wait. Bring him with us if you will, but we need to go."
Kell swallowed. "I'm sorry," he said just before forcing himself and Rye to his feet. The prince gasped in pain.
"I'm sorry."
They couldn't go by the door, couldn't parade the wounded prince in front of a palace full of people there to celebrate his birthday, and, somewhere among them, Astrid Dane. But there was a private hall between Rye's room and Kell's, one they'd used since they were boys, and now he half-dragged, half-carried his brother toward a concealed door, and then through it. He led the prince and Lila down the narrow corridor, the walls of which were covered with an assortment of odd marks, bets and challenges and personal scores kept by tallies, the tasks themselves long forgotten. A trail through their strange and sheltered youth. Now they left a trail of blood.
"Stay with me," said Kel. "Stay with me. Rye, listen to my voice."
"Such a nice voice,"
said Rye quietly, his head lolling forward.
"Rye!"
Kel heard armoured bodies break into the prince's room as they reached his own, and he shut the door to the hall and pressed his bloodied hand to the wood, and said,
"As Starrow."
"Seal." As the word left his lips, metalwork spread out from his fingers, tracing back and forth over the door and binding it shut.
"We can't keep running from bedroom to bedroom," snapped Lila. "We have to get out of this palace."
Kel knew that, knew they had to get away. He led them to the private study at the far edge of his room, the one with the blood markings on the back of the door. Shortcuts to half a dozen places in the city. The one that led to the Ruby Fields was useless now, but the others would work. He scanned the options until he found the one, the only one, he knew would be safe.
"Will this work?"
asked Lila. Kel wasn't sure. Doors within worlds were harder to make but easier to use. They could only be created by Antari, but others could, hypothetically, pass through. Indeed, Kel had led Rye through a portal once before, the day he found him on the boat. But there had been only two of them then, and now there were three.
"Don't let go," said Kel.
He drew fresh blood over the mark and held Rye and Lila as closely as he could, hoping the door and the magic would be strong enough to lead them all to sanctuary. 12. Sanctuary and Sacrifice. 1. The London Sanctuary sat at a bend in the river near the edge of the city, a stone structure with the simple elegance of a temple and an air just as reverent. It was a place where men and women came to study magic as much as worship it. Scholars and masters here spent their lives striving to comprehend and connect with the essence of power, the origin, the source, to understand the element of magic, the entity in all and yet of none. As a child, Kel had spent as much time in the sanctuary as he had in the palace, studying under and being studied by his tutor, Master Tiran. But though he visited now and then, he had not been back to stay in years, not since Rye began to throw tantrums at Kel's every absence, insisting that the latter be not only a fixture, but also a family member. Still, Tiran insisted that he would always have a room there, and so Kel had kept the door drawn on his wall, marked by a simple circle of blood with an X drawn through, the symbol of sanctuary. Now he and Lila, with a bloody Rye between them, stumbled through, out of the grandeur and current chaos of the palace, and into a simple stone room. Candlelight flickered against the smooth rock walls, and the chamber itself was narrow and high-ceilinged and sparsely furnished. The sanctuary scorned distraction, the private chambers supplied with only the essential. Kel may have been Arven, blessed, but Tiran insisted on treating him as he would any other student, a fact for which Kel was grateful. As such, his room held neither more nor less than any other. A wooden desk along one wall and a low cot along another with a small table beside it. On the table, burning as it always burned, sat an infinite candle. The room had no windows and only one door, and the air held the coolness of underground places, of crypts. A circle was etched into the floor, symbols scrawled around the edges. An enhancing sphere meant for meditation. Rye's blood trailed a path across it as Kel and Lila dragged him to the cot and laid him down as gently as possible.
"Stay with me," Kel kept saying.
but Rye's quiet, sure, and all right, and as you wish, had given way to silence and shallow breath. How many Asharis had Kell said? The word had once more become a low chant on his lips, in his head, in his heartbeat. But Rye was not healing. How long until the magic worked? It had to work. Fear clawed its way up Kell's throat. He should have looked at Astrid's weapon, should have paid attention to the metal and the markings on it. Had she done something to block his magic? Why wasn't it working?
"Stay with me," he murmured.
Rye had stopped moving. His eyes were closed and the strain had gone out of his jaw.
"Kell," Lila said softly, "I think it's too late."
"No," he said, gripping the cot. "It's not. The magic just needs time. You don't understand how it works."
"Kell,
it just needs time."
Kell pressed both hands to his brother's chest and stifled a cry. It neither rose nor fell. He couldn't feel a heartbeat underneath the ribs.
"I can't,"
he said, gasping as if he too was starved of air.
"I can't."
Kell's voice wavered as his fingers tangled in his brother's bloody shirt.
"I can't give up."
"It's over," said Lila. "There's nothing you can do."
But that wasn't true. There was still something. All the warmth went out of Kell's body, but so did the hesitation and the confusion and the fear. He knew what to do, knew what he had to do.
"Give me the stone," he said.
"No."
"Lila, give me the bloody stone before it's too late."
"It's already too late. He's..."
"He's not dead," snapped Kell. He held out a stained and shaking hand. "Give it to me."
Lila's hand went to her pocket and hovered there.
"There's a reason I'm holding it, Kell," she said.
"Damn it, Lila. Please."
She let out a shaky breath and withdrew the stone. He ripped it from her fingers, ignoring the pulse of power up his arm as he turned back to Rye's body.
"You told me yourself nothing good comes out of this,"
said Lila as Kell set the stone over Rye's unbeating heart and pressed his palm down on top of it.
"I know you're upset, but you can't think that this..."
But he couldn't hear. Her voice dissolved along with everything else as Kell focused on the magic coursing in his veins.
"Save him,"
he ordered the stone. Power sang through his blood and smoke poured out from under his fingers. It snaked up his arm and around Rye's ribs, turning to blackened rope as it tangled around them, tying them together, binding them. But Rye still lay there, unmoving.
"My life is his life," thought Kell. "His life is mine. Bind it to mine and bring him back."
He could feel the magic, hungry and wanting, pushing against him, trying to tap into his body, his power, his life force. And this time, he let it in. As soon as he did, the black rope tightened and Kell's heart lurched in his chest. It skipped a beat, and Rye's heart caught it, thudding once beneath Kell's touch. For an instant, all he felt was relief, joy. Then, pain. Like being torn apart one nerve at a time. Kell screamed as he doubled forward over the prince, but he didn't let go. Rye's back arched under his hand, the dark coils of magic cinching around them. The pain only worsened, carved itself in burning strokes over Kell's skin, his heart, his life.
"Kell!"
Lila's voice broke through the fog and he saw her rushing forward a step and then two, already reaching out to stop him, to pull him free of the spell.
"Stop," he thought.
He didn't say it, didn't raise a finger, but the magic was in his head and it heard his will. It rushed through him and the smoke rushed out and slammed Lila backward. She hit the stone wall hard and crumpled to the floor. Something in Kell stirred, distant and hushed.
Wrong, it whispered. This is...
But then another wave of pain sent him reeling. Power pounded through his veins, and his head came to rest against his brother's ribs as the pain tore through him, skin and muscle, bone and soul. Rye gasped, and so did Kell, his heart skipping once more in his chest. And then it stopped. 2. The room went deathly still. Kell's hands slipped from Rye's ribs, and his body tumbled from the cot to the stone floor with a sickening thud. Lila's ears were still ringing from the force of her head meeting the wall as she pushed herself to her hands and knees, and then to her feet. Kell wasn't moving, wasn't breathing. And then, after a moment that seemed to last hours, he drew a deep, shuddering breath. And so did Rye. Lila swore with relief as she knelt over Kell. His shirt was open, his stomach and chest streaked with blood, but under that, a black symbol, made up of concentric circles, was branded into his skin, directly over his heart. Lila looked up at the cot. The same mark was scrawled over Rye's bloody chest.
"What have you done?" she whispered.
She didn't know that much about magic, but she was fairly certain that bringing someone back from the dead was solidly in the bad column. If all magic came at a price, what had this cost Kell? As if in answer, his eyes floated open. Lila was relieved to see that one of them was still blue. There had been an instant during the spell when both had gone solid black.
"Welcome back," she said.
Kell groaned, and Lila helped him up into a sitting position on the cold stone floor. His attention went to the bed, where Rye's chest rose and fell in a slow but steady motion. His eyes went from the mark on the prince's skin to the mirrored mark on his own, which he touched, wincing faintly.
"What did you do?"
asked Lila.
"I bound Rye's life to mine," he said hoarsely. "As long as I survive, so will he."
"That seems like a dangerous spell."
"It's not a spell," he said softly.
She didn't know if he lacked the strength to speak louder or was afraid of waking his brother.
"It's called a soul seal. Spells can be broken. A soul seal cannot. This is a piece of permanent magic. But this,"
he added, grazing the mark,
"this is
forbidden,"
ventured Lila.
"Impossible," said Kell. "This kind of magic, it doesn't exist."
He seemed dazed and distant as he got to his feet, and Lila tensed when she saw that he was still gripping the stone. Black veins traced up his arm.
"You need to let go of that now."
Kell looked down as if he'd forgotten he was holding it. But when he managed to unclench his fingers, the talisman didn't fall out. Threads of black spun out from the rock, winding down his fingers and up his wrist. He stared down at the stone for several long moments.
"It appears I can't," he said at last.
"Isn't that bad?" pressed Lila.
"Yes," he said, and his calm worried her more than anything. "But I didn't have a choice. I had to..."
He trailed off, turning toward Rye.
"Kell, are you all right?"
It seemed an absurd question, given the circumstances, and Kell gave her a look that said as much. So Lila added,
"When you were doing that spell, you weren't you."
"Well, I am now."
"Are you sure about that?"
she asked, gesturing at his hand.
"Because that's new."
Kell frowned.
"That rock is bad magic. You said it yourself. It feeds on energy, on people. And now it straps itself to you. You can't tell me that doesn't worry you."
"Lila," he said darkly, "I couldn't let him die."
"But what you've done instead..."
"I did what I had to do," he said. "I suppose it doesn't matter. I am already lost."
Lila scowled. "What do you mean by that?" Kell's eyes softened a little.
"Someone has to return the stone to Black London, Lila. It's not just a matter of opening a door and casting the object through. I have to take it there. I have to walk through with it."
Kell looked down at the stone, binding itself to his hand.
"I never expected to make it back."
"Christ, Kell!" growled Lila. "If you're not going to bother staying alive, then what's the damn point? Why tether Rye's life to yours if you're just going to throw it away?"
Kell cringed.
"So long as I live, so will he. And I didn't say I planned on dying."
"But you just said..."
"I said I'm not coming back. The seals on Black London were designed less to keep anyone from going in and more to keep anyone from getting out. I can't strip the spells. And even if I could, I wouldn't. And with the spells intact, even if I manage to make a door into Black London, the seals will never let me back out."
"You weren't going to mention any of this. You were just going to let me follow you on a one-way trip to..."
"You said you wanted an adventure," snapped Kell. "And no, I never intended to let you..."
Just then the door swung open. Kell and Lila fell silent, their argument echoing on the walls of the narrow stone chamber. An old man was standing in the doorway wearing a black robe, one hand against the door frame, the other holding up a sphere of pale white light. He wasn't old in a withered way. In fact, he stood straight and broad-shouldered, his age belied only by his white hair and the deep creases on his face, made deeper by the shadows cast from the light in his palm. Kell pulled his coat around himself and buried his damaged hand in his pocket.
"Master Tirren,"
he said casually, as if the informality of his voice could cover up the fact that he and Lila were streaked with blood and standing in front of the body of a nearly dead prince.
"Kell," said the man, frowning deeply. "Kersla? Ilvanash Mare?"
And then he trailed off and looked at Lila. His eyes were pale and startlingly blue. They seemed to go straight through her. His brow furrowed, and then he began speaking again, this time in English, as if he could tell with a single glance that she did not understand, did not belong.
"What brings you here?"
he asked, addressing both of them.
"You said I would always have a room," answered Kell wearily. "I'm afraid I had need of it."
He stepped aside so that Master Tirren could see the wounded prince. The man's eyes went wide, and he touched his fingers to his lips in a small prayer-like gesture.
"Is he..."
"He's alive," said Kell, hand drifting to his collar to hide the mark. "But the palace is under attack. I cannot explain everything, not now, but you must believe me, Tirren. It has been taken by traitors. They are using forbidden magic, possessing the bodies and minds of those around them. No one is safe. Nowhere is safe. And no one is to be trusted."
He was breathless by the time he finished.
Tirren crossed to Kell in a handful of slow strides.
He took Kell's face in his hands, the gesture strangely intimate, and looked into his eyes as he had Lila's, as if he could see past them.
"What have you done to yourself?"
Kell's voice caught in his throat.
"Only what I had to do."
His coat had fallen open, and the man's gaze drifted down to the blackened mark over Kell's heart.
"Please," he said, sounding frightened. "I would not have brought danger into these halls, but I had no choice."
The man's hands fell away.
"The sanctuary is warded against darkness. The prince will be safe within these walls."
Relief swept across Kell's features. Tirren turned to consider Lila a second time.
"You are not from here,"
he said by way of introduction. Lila held out her hand.
Delilah bowed.
The man took it, and something like a shiver, but warmer, passed beneath her skin, a calm spreading through her in its wake.
"My name is Master Tirren," he said. "I am the Onasa Arvan, that is to say, the head priest of the London Sanctuary, and a healer," he added, as if to explain the sensation.
Their hands fell apart, and Tiran went to the prince's side and brought his bony fingers to rest feather-light on top of Rai's chest.
"His injuries are severe."
"I know," said Kell shakily. "I can feel them as if they were my own."
Lila tensed, and Tiran's expression darkened.
"Then I will do what I can to ease his pain, and yours."
Kell nodded gratefully.
"It's my fault," he said. "But I will set things right."
Tiran opened his mouth to speak, but Kell stopped him.
"I cannot tell you," he said. "I must ask for your trust as well as your discretion."
Tiran's mouth became a thin line.
"I will lead you to the tunnels," he said. "From there you will be able to find your way,
whichever way you need." Kell had been silent since leaving the small room. He hadn't been able to look at his brother, hadn't been able to say goodbye, had only swallowed and nodded and turned away, following Master Tiran out. Lila trailed behind, picking Rai's dried blood from the cuffs of her new coat. She supposed she would have had to get her hands and sleeves dirty sooner or later. As they made their way through the bowels of the sanctuary, she watched Kell and the way his gaze hung on Tiran, as if willing the priest to say something. But the priest kept his mouth shut and his eyes ahead, and eventually Kell's step began to trail, until he and Lila were side by side in the head priest's wake.
"The clothing suits you," he said quietly. "Do I want to know how you came by it?"
Lila tilted her head.
"I didn't steal it, if that's what you're asking. I bought it from a woman in the market named Kella."
Kell smiled faintly at the name.
"And how did you pay for it?"
"I haven't yet," retorted Lila, "but that doesn't mean I won't."
Her gaze dropped away.
"Though I don't know when I'll have the chance."
"You will," said Kell, "because you're staying here."
"Like hell I am,"
shot Lila.
"The sanctuary will keep you safe."
"I will not be left behind."
Kell shook his head.
"You were never meant to go farther. When I said yes, I did so with the intent to leave you here in my city to deliver word of my fate to the king and queen."
Lila drew a breath, but he held up his uninjured hand. "And to keep you safe. White London is no place for a grey worlder."
"It's no place for anyone."
"I'll be the judge of that," she said.
"I'm going with you." "Lila, this isn't some game. Enough people have died, and I..."
"You're right. It's not a game," pressed Lila. "It's a strategy. I hope what the Queen said about the stone being broken in two. You need to dispose of both pieces, and as of right now, you only have one. The White King has the other, right? Which means we have our work cut out for us. And it is we, Kell. Two of them means there should be two of us as well. You can take the king, and I'll handle the queen."
"You're no match for Astrid Dane."
"Tell me, do you underestimate everyone or just me? Is it because I'm a girl?"
"It's because you're a human," he snapped.
"Because you may be the bravest, boldest soul I've ever met, but you're still too much flesh and blood and too little power.
Astrid Dane is made of magic and malice."
"Yes, well, that's all well and good for her, but she's not even in her body, is she?" "She's here, having a grand time in Red London. Which means she should make an easy target."
Lila gave him the sharpest edge of a grin.
"And I may be human, but I've made it this far."
Kell frowned deeply. "It is amazing," thought Lila, "that he doesn't have more wrinkles."
"You have," he said. "But no farther."
"The girl has power in her," offered Tiran without looking back.
Lila brightened.
"See," she preened. "I've been telling you that all along."
"What kind of power?"
asked Kell, raising a brow.
"Don't sound so skeptical,"
Lila shot back.
"Unnurtured," said Tiran. "Untended. unawakened.
Well, come on then, O Nasa Arvin, she said, holding out her hands. Wake it up.
Tirin glanced back and offered her a ghost of a smile.
It shall awake on its own, Delilah Bard, and if you nurture it, it will grow.
She comes from the other London, said Kel. Tirin showed no surprise. The one without magic.
No London is truly without magic, observed the priest.
And human or not, added Lila sharply, I'd like to remind you that you're still alive because of me. I'm the reason that White Queen's not wearing you like a coat.
And I've got something you need.
What's that?
Lila pulled the white rook from her pocket.
The key.
Kel's eyes widened a fraction in surprise and then narrowed.
Do you honestly think you could keep it from me if I wished to take it?
In an instant, Lila had the rook in one hand and her knife in the other. The brass knuckles of the handle glinted in the candlelight while the stone hummed low and steady, as if whispering to Kel.
Try it,
she sneered.
Kel stopped walking and looked at her.
What is wrong with you?
He asked, sounding honestly baffled.
Do you care so little about your life that you would throw it all away for a few hours of adventure and a violent death?
Lila frowned.
She'd admit that in the beginning all she wanted was an adventure, but that wasn't why she was insisting now.
The truth was she'd seen the change in Kel, seen the shadows sweep across his eyes when he summoned that clever cursed magic, seen how hard it was for him to return to his senses after. Every time he used the stone he seemed to lose a bigger piece of himself. So no, Lila wasn't going with him just to satisfy some thirst for danger, and she wasn't going with him just to keep him company. She was going because they'd come this far and because she feared he wouldn't succeed, not alone.
My life is mine to spend, she said, and I will not spend it here, no matter how nice your city is or how much safer it might be. We had a deal, Kel. And you now have Tirin to guard your story and heal your brother. I'm of no use to him. Let me be of use to you.
Kel looked her in the eyes.
You will be trapped there, he said, when it is over.
Lila shivered.
Perhaps, she said, or perhaps I will go with you to the end of the world. After all, you've made me curious.
Lila. His eyes were dark with pain and worry, but she only smiled.
One adventure at a time, she said.
They reached the edge of the tunnel and Tirin pushed open a pair of metal gates. The Red River glowed up at them from below. They were standing on its northern bank, the palace shimmering in the distance, still surrounded by starry light, as if nothing were amiss. Tirin brought his hand to Kel's shoulder and murmured something in Arnesian before adding in English,
May the saints and source of all be with you both.
Kel nodded and gripped the priest's hand with his unwounded one before stepping out into the evening. But as Lila went to follow, Tirin caught her arm. He squinted at her as if searching for a secret.
What?
Asked Lila.
How did you lose it?
He asked. Lila frowned.
Lose what?
His weathered fingers drifted up beneath her chin.
Your eye.
Lila pulled her face from his grip, her hand going to the darker of her two brown eyes, the one made of glass. Few people ever noticed. Her hair cut a sharp line across her face, and even when she did look someone in the eye, they rarely held the gaze for long enough to mark the difference.
I don't remember, she said.
It wasn't a lie.
I was a child, and it was an accident, I'm told.
Hmm, said Tirin pensively. Does Kel know?
Her frown deepened.
Does it matter?
After a long moment, the old man tilted his head.
I suppose not, he said.
Kel was looking back at Lila, waiting for her.
If the darkness takes him,
said Tirin under his breath, You must end his life. He looked at her, through her. Do you think you can? Lila didn't know whether he wanted to know if she had the strength or the will.
If he dies, she said, so will Rye.
Tiran sighed. Then the world will be as it should, he said sadly, instead of as it is. Lila swallowed and nodded. I went to join Kel.
To White London, then?
She asked when she reached him, holding out the rook. Kel did not move. He was staring out at the river and the palace arching over it. She thought he might be taking in his London, his home, saying his goodbyes. But then he spoke. The bones are the same in every world, he said, gesturing to the city. But the rest of it will be different. As different as this world is from yours. He pointed across the river and toward the centre of London. Where we're going? The castle is there. Athos and Astra will be there too. Once we cross through, stay close. Do not leave my side. It is night here, which means it is night in White London too, and the city is full of shadows. Kel looked at Lila. You can still change your mind. Lila straightened and tugged up the collar of her coat. She smiled.
Not a chance.
3. The palace was in a state of upheaval. Guests were spilling, confused and concerned, down the great stairs, ushered out by the royal guards. Rumours spread like fire through the crowd, rumours of violence and death and wounded royalty. Words like treason and coup and assassin filled the air, only feeding the frenzy. Someone claimed that a guard had been murdered. Another claimed to have seen that guard fall from the prince's balcony to the courtyard below. Another still said that a woman in a green gown had stolen a necklace from the gruesome scene and rushed into the palace. Another insisted he'd seen her thrust the pendant into the hands of another guard and then collapse at his feet. The guard had not even called for help. He'd simply stormed away toward the royal chambers. There, the king and queen had withdrawn, their strange calm only adding to the guests' confusion. The guard had vanished into their room, and a moment later the king had apparently burst forth, his steadiness cast off as he shouted about treason. He claimed that the prince had been stabbed and that Kel was to blame, demanding the Antari's arrest. And just like that, the confusion shattered into panic, chaos billowing like smoke through the night. By the time Jen's boots approached the palace, the stairs were crowded with worried guests. The thing inside Jen's armour turned its black eyes up at the dancing lights and jostling bodies. It wasn't the mayhem that drew him there. It was the scent. Someone had used strong magic, beautiful magic, and he meant to find out who. He set off up the stairs, pressing past the flustered guests. No one seemed to notice that his armour was rent, peeled back over the heart, a stain like black wax across his front. Nor did they notice the blood, Parrish's blood, splashed across the metal. When he reached the top of the stairs, he drew a deep breath and smiled. The night hung heavy with panic and power, the energy filling his lungs, stoking him like coals. He could smell the magic now. He could taste it. And he was hungry. He'd chosen his latest shell quite well. The guards in their commotion let him pass. It wasn't until he was inside, through the flower-lined antechamber and striding across the emptied ballroom, that a helmeted figure stopped him. "Jen!" demanded the guard. "Where have you—" But the words died in the guard's throat when he saw the man's eyes. "Marsavan!" The oath was cut off by Jin's sword, sliding through armour and between ribs. The guard dragged in a single shuddering breath and tried to cry out, but the sword cut sideways and up, and the air died in his throat. Easing the body down, the thing wearing Jin's skin resheathed his weapon and removed the guard's helmet, sliding it over his own head. When he pulled the visor down, his black eyes were nothing but a glint through the metal slit. Footsteps sounded through the palace and shouted orders echoed overhead. He straightened. The air was full of blood and magic, and he went to find its source. The stone still sang in Kell's hand, but not quite the way it had before. Now the melody, the thrum of power, seemed to be singing in his bones instead of over them. Every moment he felt it in his heartbeat and in his head. With it came a strange quiet, a calm, one he trusted even less than the initial surge of power. The calm told him everything would be well. It cooed and soothed and steadied his heart, and made Kell forget that anything was wrong, made him forget that he was holding the stone at all. That was the worst part. It was bound to his hand, and yet it hung at the outside of his senses. He had to fight to remember it was there with him, inside of him. Every time he remembered, it was like waking from a dream, full of panic and fear, only to be dragged down into sleep again. In those brief moments of clarity, he wanted to claw free, break or tear or cut the stone from his skin. But he didn't, because competing with that urge to cast it off was the equal opposite desire to hold it close, to cling to its warmth as if he were dying of cold. He needed its strength, now more than ever. Kell didn't want Lila to see how scared he was, but he thought she saw it anyway. They had woven back toward the city centre. The streets mostly deserted on this side of the river, but had yet to cross any of the bridges that arced back and forth over the isle. It was too dangerous, too exposed. Especially since halfway there, Kell's face had reappeared on the scrying boards that lined the streets. Only this time, instead of saying, "missing," it now said, "wanted, for treason, murder, and abduction." Kell's chest tightened at the accusations, but he held fast to the fact that Rye was safe as he could possibly be. His fingers went to the brand over his heart. If he focused, he could feel the echo of Rye's heartbeat, the pulse a fraction of time after his own. He looked around, trying to picture the streets not only as they were here, but as they would be in white London, superimposing the images in his mind. "This will have to do," he said. Where they stood now at the mouth of an alley across from a string of ships, Lila had surveyed them with an appraising eye. They would stand before a bridge in the next city, a bridge that led to a street that ended at the walls of the White Castle. As they'd walked, Kell had described to Lila the dangers of the other London, from its twin rulers to its starving, power-hungry populace. And then he had described the castle on the bones of his plan, because bones were all he had right now. Bones and hope. Hope that they would make it, that he would be able to hold on to himself long enough to beat Athos and retrieve the second half of the stone. And then... Kell closed his eyes and took a low, steadying breath. "One adventure at a time," Lila's words echoed in his mind.
"What are we waiting for?"
Lila was leaning against the wall. She tapped the bricks.
"Come on, Kell. Door time."
At her casual air, her defiant energy, the way even now she didn't seem concerned or afraid, only excited him, gave him strength. The gash across his palm, though now partially obscured by the black stone, was still fresh. He touched the cup with his finger and drew a mark on the brick wall in front of them. Lila took his hand, palm to palm with the stones singing between them, and offered him the white rook, and he brought it to the blood on the wall, swallowing his nerves.
"As travas," he commanded.
And the world softened and darkened around them as they stepped forward and through the newly hewn doorway. Or at least, that's how it should have happened. But halfway through the stride, a force jarred Kell backward, tearing Lila's hand from his as it ripped him out of the place between worlds and back onto the hard stone street of Red London. Kell blinked up at the night, dazed, and then realized he was not alone.
Someone was standing over him. At first the figure was no more than a shadow rolling up his sleeves, and then Kell saw the silver circle glittering at his collar.
Holland looked down at him and frowned.
"Leaving so soon?"
4. Lila's black boots landed on the pale street. Her head spun a little from the sudden change, and she steadied herself against the wall. She heard the sound of Kell's steps behind her.
"Well, that's an improvement," she said, turning. "At least we're in the same place, this..."
But he wasn't there. She was standing on the curb in front of a bridge, the white castle rising in the distance across the river, which was neither grey nor red, but a pearly, half-frozen stretch of water shining dully in the thickening night. Lanterns along the river burned with a pale blue fire that cast the world in a strange, colourless way, and Lila in her crisp black clothes stood out as much a light in the dark. Something shone near her feet, and she looked down to find the white rook on the ground, its pale surface still dotted with Kell's blood. But no Kell. She picked up the token and pocketed it, trying to swallow her rising nerves. Nearby, a starved dog was watching her with empty eyes. And then quickly Lila became aware of other eyes, in windows and doorways, and in the shadows between pools of sickly light. Her hand went to the knife with the metal knuckles.
"Kell?"
she called out under her breath, but there was no answer. Maybe it was like last time. Maybe they'd simply been separated and he was making his way toward her now. Maybe. But Lila had felt the strange pull as they stepped through, had felt his hand vanish from hers too soon. Footsteps echoed, and she turned in a slow circle but saw no one. Kell had warned her of this world. He'd called it dangerous. But so much of Lila's own world had fit that term, so she hadn't given it much stock. After all, he'd grown up in a palace and she'd grown up on the streets. And Lila thought she knew a good bit more about bad alleys and worse men than Kell. Now, standing here alone, Lila was beginning to think she hadn't given him enough credit. Anyone, even a highborn, could see the danger here, could smell it. Death and ash and winter air. She shivered, not only from cold but from fear. A simple bone-deep sense of wrong. It was like looking into Holland's black eye. For the first time, Lila wished she had more than knives and the flintlock.
"Ovos derevaik!"
came a voice to her right, and she spun to see a man, bald, every inch of exposed skin from the crown of his head down to his fingers, covered in tattoos. Whatever he was speaking, it didn't sound like Arnesian. It was gruff and guttural. And even though she didn't know the word, she could grasp the tone, and she didn't like it.
"Tovakos masterna,"
said another, appearing to her left, his skin like parchment. The first man chuckled. The second tisked. Lila pulled the knife free.
"Stay back,"
she ordered, hoping her gesture would make up for any language barrier. The men exchanged a look, and then withdrew their own jagged weapons. A cold breeze cut through, and Lila fought down a shiver. The men broke into rotting grins. She lowered her knife. And then in one smooth move she drew the pistol from her belt, raised it, and shot the first man between the eyes. He went down like a sack of stones, and Lila smiled before she realized how loud the gunshot sounded. She hadn't noticed how quiet the city was until the shot rang out, the blast carrying down the streets. All around them doors began to open. Shadows moved. Whispers and murmurs came from corners of the street, first one, then two, then half a dozen. The second man, the one with papery skin, looked at the dead one and then at Lila. He started talking again in a low, threatening growl, and Lila was glad she didn't speak his tongue. She didn't want to know what he was saying.
Slivers of dark energy crackled through the air around the man's blade. She could feel people moving behind her, the shadows taking shape into people, gaunt and grey.
"Come on, Kel," she thought as she raised the gun again. "Where are you?"
5.
"Let me pass," said Kel.
Holland only raised a brow.
"Please," said Kel. "I can end this."
"Can you?" challenged Holland. "I do not think you have it in you."
His gaze went to Kel's hand, the dark magic twining around it.
"I warned you, magic is not about balance. It is about dominance. You control it, or it controls you."
"I am still in control,"
said Kel through gritted teeth.
"No," said Holland. "You're not. Once you let the magic in, you've already lost."
Kel's chest tightened.
"I don't want to fight you, Holland. You do not have a choice."
Holland wore a sharpened ring on one hand and used it now to cut a line across his palm. Blood dripped to the street.
"As Isera," he said softly.
"Freeze." The dark drops hit the ground and turned to black ice, shooting forward across the street. Kel tried to step back, but the ice moved too fast, and within seconds he was standing on top of it, fighting for balance.
"Do you know what makes you weak?" said Holland. "You've never had to be strong. You've never had to try. You've never had to fight. And you certainly never had to fight for your life. But tonight that changes, Kel. Tonight, if you do not fight, you will die. And if you..."
Kel didn't wait for him to finish. A sudden gust of wind whipped forward, nearly knocking Kel off balance, as it cycloned toward Holland. It surrounded the Antari, swallowing him from sight. The wind whistled, but through it Kel could hear a low, haunting sound. And then he realized it was a laugh. Holland was laughing. A moment later, Holland's blood-streaked hand appeared, parting the cyclone wall. And then the rest of him stepped through the column of wind crumbling around him.
"Air cannot be made sharp," he chided. "Cannot hurt, cannot kill. You should choose your elements with more care. Watch."
Holland moved with such smooth swiftness it was hard to follow his motions, let alone keep up. In a single fluid move, he dropped to a knee and touched the ground and said,
"As Steno."
Break. The paving stone beneath his palm shattered into a dozen sharpened shards, and as he stood, the shards came with him, hovering in the air the way the nails had done in the alley. He flicked his wrist, and the shard shot forward through the air toward Kel. The stone against his palm sang with warning, and he barely had time to throw up his hand, the talisman shining in it, and say, "Stop!" The smoke poured forth and caught the slivers in their path, crushing them to dust. Power shot through Kel with the command, followed instantly by something darker, colder. He gasped at the sensation. He could feel the magic climbing over his skin and under it, and he willed it to stop, pushed back with all his strength as the smoke dissolved. Holland was shaking his head.
"Go ahead, Kel. Use the stone. It will consume you faster. But you might just win."
Kel swore under breath and summoned another cyclone, this one in front of him. He snapped the fingers of the hand without the stone. A flame appeared in his palm, and when he touched it to the twisting air, it took it, engulfing the wind in fire. The burning cyclone scorched across the ground, melting the ice as it charged toward Holland, who threw out his hand and summoned the ground up into a shield. And then, the instant the flame was gone, sent the stone walls surging toward Kel. He threw up his hands, fighting for control over the rocks, and realized too late that they were only a distraction for the arcing wave of water that struck him from behind. The surge from the river slammed Kell to his hands and knees, but before he could recover, it swept him up and coiled around him. In moments, Kell was trapped by the swell, gasping for air before it swallowed him entirely. He fought, pinned by the force of the water.
"Astrid wanted you alive,"
said Holland, drawing the curved blade from beneath his cloak.
"She insisted upon it."
His free hand curled into a fist, and the water tightened, crushing the air from Kell's lungs.
"But I'm sure she will understand if I have no choice but to kill you in order to retrieve the stone."
Holland strode toward him with measured steps over the icy ground, the curved blade hanging at his side. And Kell twisted and thrashed, scouring for something, anything he could use. He reached for the life in Holland's grip, but the metal was warded and it didn't even quiver. Kell was running out of air, and Holland was nearly to him. And then, through the wall of water, he saw the rippling image of the ship supplies, the pile of boards and poles, and the dark metal of chains coiled on posts by the bridge. Kell's fingers twitched, and the nearest set of chains flew forward, wrapping around Holland's wrist, jarring his focus. The water lost its shape and fell apart, and Kell stumbled forward to the ground, soaking wet and gasping for breath. Holland was still trying to free himself, and Kell knew he couldn't afford to hesitate. Another set of chains from another post snaked around the Antari's leg and up his waist. Holland moved to throw the curved blade, but a third set of chains caught his arm and drew taut. It wouldn't hold, not for long. Kell willed a metal pole up from the dock floor and threw the air, the bar hovering a foot or so behind Holland.
"I can't let you win," said Kell. "Then you'd better kill me," growled Holland. "If you don't, it will never end."
Kell drew the knife from his forearm and lifted it as if to strike.
"You're going to have to try harder than that," said Holland as Kell's hand froze,
the bones held still by the other Antari's will. It was exactly what Kell was hoping for. The moment Holland's focus was on the knife, Kell attacked, not from the front, but from behind, willing the metal bar forward with all his strength. It soared through the air and found its mark, striking Holland in the back with enough force to pierce through cloak and skin and bone. It protruded from Holland's chest, the metal and blood obscuring the seal scarred over his heart. The silver circle clasp broke and tumbled away, the half-cloak sliding off Holland's shoulders as his knees folded. Kell staggered to his feet as Holland collapsed onto the damp street. A horrible sadness rolled through him as he crossed to the Antari's body. They had been two of a kind, a dying breed. Now he was the only one. And soon there would be none. Perhaps that was how it should be, how it needed to be. Kell wrapped his fingers around the bloody metal bar and pulled it free of Holland's chest. He tossed the pole aside, the dull sound of it clanking down the road like a faltering heartbeat. Kell knelt beside Holland's body as blood began to pool beneath it. When he felt for a pulse, he found one there, but it was shallow, fading.
"I'm sorry," he said.
It felt stupid and useless to say, but the sharpness had gone out of his anger, and his sadness, his fear, his loss. They had all dulled into a steady ache, one he felt he might never shake as he reached under the Antari's collar and found a white London token on a cord around his neck. Holland knew. He'd seen the attack coming, and he hadn't stopped it. The instant before the metal struck him from behind, Holland had stopped fighting. It was only a second, a fraction of a breath, but it had been enough to give Kell the edge, the opening. And in the sliver of time after the metal pierced his body and before he fell, it wasn't anger or pain that crossed his face. It was relief. Kell snapped the cord and straightened. But he couldn't bring himself to leave the Antari there, in the street. He looked from the token